Over the weekend, we went to the Indie Symposium 423 held by the Game On guys. It was rather excellent. It was a cool melting pot of indie devs and gamers sort of getting together to network, show off each other's ideas, and there were also some seminars and some like talks from some key speakers.
Also, there was pizza.
Yep, courtesy of the Half Brick guys. Thanks for that.
You weren't there on day two. On day two, there was a barbecue courtesy of the Quantum College guys.
Wow.
Damn it.
Awesome.
Why did I miss that?
So, Jody, you were there for the whole thing. What were your highlights?
A surprising highlight was on day one, a guy named Michael Bowie, who's a lawyer, came in and to do a talk about IP and copyright law as it relates to games, which I'm sure is very useful for developers, but I was surprised at how interesting it actually was. There were so many people, you could see them taking notes through the entire thing as he's explaining all these ideas about how copyright protects the expression of ideas and not the ideas themselves. So if you haven't actually done anything with your ideas, then people can totally steal them.
Mm.
And it's your fault for telling them your ideas.
Ah.
Everybody pulled their notepads and their phones out and wrote that down. They wrote down, don't tell people stuff or write it down.
Absolutely.
That's why people were incredibly silent during most of the interviews that followed. We were like, so, what are you working on next?
Yeah.
Nothing.
I cannot tell you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anything else, Jody?
It was cool to hear John Passfield, who designed a lot of classic games like Halloween Harry and Flight of the Amazon Queen, talk about, because he's been doing it since the 80s, since before, you know, indie games were even called indie games, when it was just guys in their bedrooms with ZX81 Spectrums. And he used a Micro B, which was this Australian designed computer that's a bajillion years old. And his first games came out on cassette. And he's like making Facebook games and stuff like that now. He hasn't stopped.
Does he still use the Micro B?
I hope so.
Or has he moved on to an Apple IIc?
He might. Maybe an Amiga.
Okay, well, we had a chance to sit down with a few of the developers, and this is what they had to say.
Hi, I'm Liam Hill, and I'm a designer and producer at Client Development. So most recently we put out a Heroes Call on iOS and Android. It's a free-to-play dungeon crawler, a bit like something like an early Diablo game made for your tablet and phone. Yeah, I think like most people that are in the games industry, I've been playing games since a very, very early age. My dad used to program his own games or games out of magazines when that was a thing that people did for the Atari 400, really old one with the pop-up flip that you put the cartridges in. And this is back in the day when you still got games on tape as well that would take what would feel like hours to load. So he used to make his own games and he used to see that happen and used to play old Atari games and then onto the Nintendo Entertainment System. I think that was the tipping point where that was the end of any other future career for me. As soon as I played Super Mario, that was it for me. So the bar's a lot lower now for what you need to make a game than it used to be. You don't need to make an iPhone game, you don't need a team of 150 people in 3 years. You can make something a lot quicker and easier than that. But the problem is everyone can make something quicker and easier than that. And it's now about making people aware of your game, getting them to try it in the first place, and then to keep them coming back. If your game like Heroes Call that's based on in-app purchases, you've got to keep giving the player reason to come back to your game rather than just going to the whatever the marketplace is and getting the newest game from them. And that's a much different challenge to the one that lots of us have had with the console game market. I think we feel that there's a decent room in the free-to-play market for a core game, that, you know, a Diablo-alike, that we can then continue to support with new features and content, and that that'll be worthwhile for us and for the players. Especially for me as a designer, I've got lots and lots of ideas for new characters and enemies that we can make within the constraints of Heroes Call. So I think we've got lots of room to do new stuff before we need to move on to a new project.
What's the best part about being independent?
I guess it's the double-edged sword of, you know, of freedom, of being, you know, being able to choose exactly what you want to do, but then also having to live by that same sword. The results of those choices are going to be played out in the iTunes store and the Google Marketplace. So it's sort of a
advice would you give to someone thinking of entering into the industry at this point?
One would be that being multi-skilled is probably advantageous these days. You know, lots of companies need to be agile and flexible and these types of things where they can be able to adapt to new projects that come out. And then the second would be to just make as much stuff as possible, especially if you're a designer that doesn't necessarily have great programming skills. It can feel like it's tough for you to make something that can show you off or show off your skills to potential employers, but I don't think it matters. It doesn't necessarily need to be making games. You know, be making board game prototypes, card games, pen and paper RPGs, video games if you can. That process of making something, tweaking it and testing it and then making more changes and finishing something small is really, really valuable.
Where can we get more information about Defiant on the internet?
You can find us and the games we make at www.defiantdev.com.
Lee Malcolm Reiki, lead creative at Genius Interaction.
Hi, my name is Nathan Runge. I'm the managing director, but I also take care of the programming and a lot of the production stuff.
Okay, so our first game out the gate is Viking Burger. It's a brutal burger-making simulator for the Windows Phone 7. It's a game where you take on the role of a defrosted Viking from the Middle Ages, and you're forced into servitude at a burger joint where you must make burgers. Problem is that the Viking tends to enter blood rages and murder people. So the real goal is making burgers that are good enough for people to risk death to come eat. I had a very bad year where I worked at a fried chicken place, and the managers were awful, and the customers were awful, and just an all-around lack of respect, which really made me think about how much better things would have been for everyone if we had all just not been jerks.
There have been a lot of challenges in terms of securing the funding you need when you're coming in. We've really been rather underfunded. Otherwise, what is that? You lose a little bit of perspective sitting in your flat at a computer screen large amounts of the day. But that's why these sort of events are really good.
Because you come out and you remember why you're doing it, and you see people playing your game, and you're like, oh, that's right, that's what it was all about, you know? Like, it wasn't just a meaningless thing that I was drawing, you know, over countless hours. As a kid, I don't really get people too well, a stranger friend me. So I spent most of my time, you know, watching cartoons and things like that, and I really enjoyed it. And honestly, I just want to give back. I want someone to enjoy my stuff as much as I enjoyed their stuff, you know? I want to make something that people will grow up with, yep. I guess. And games are the best way for me to be able to tell stories to people and have them to relate to me.
I come from a bit of a different background. I studied a lot of literature at school. I did a high level of English in high school. To me, games are an untapped medium that we haven't really explored the potential yet. That might seem a little separate from Murderous Vikings, but, you know, small steps.
The next game we've got, which we're doing prep for, is called Boss, which is kind of it's a reverse platformer game, where instead of you playing like a character like Mario, where your goal is to overcome an environment, your goal in Boss is to make the environment unbeatable by placing a series of traps and minions and things like that to protect your king.
It's been described as a reverse or a side-scrolling tower defense, is a good way of putting it, which is.
Check us out at www.facebook.com/genius_interaction for all your latest Genius Interaction updates on our latest games and creations. Yeah!
Wow.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for that, guys.
My name is Anthony Wood. I am co-founder, creative director, and lead programmer of Screwtape Studios.
And I'm Megan Summers, the other co-founder of Screwtape Studios, and I'm also producer, admin, business, finance, and QA.
Bank Job is an iPhone and Android game. There's a little thief. His name's Polly Barboza, and he's just robbed the world's most high security bank. And it's now his job to get out. And along the way, there's some traps that have been set for him so that he doesn't make his way out. And it's your job to make him avoid the traps, but also collect some of the loot that's being thrown down the hallway because he didn't do his job very well, and there's still a little bit of loot left in the hall. Avoid the traps and collect as much loot as you can. See how far you can get down the hallway and how much money you can get.
Screwtape Studios started really out of passion and necessity. We always knew we wanted to make start our own games company. it just happened much quicker than we thought, because all of a sudden there were no other games companies in Brisbane to be working at. So independent development, and with the iPhone having really hit its stride with iPhone games and a lot of other programs that we could make iPhone games with, it just felt like the best time to jump into that market. It was really open for us.
I don't think people want to work for someone else. In a really creative industry, I think you want to call your own shots. And I'm fairly strong-headed, and I want to make the games that I want to make. And really, the only way to do that is to start your own company and call your own shots. I mean, I think we're creating games that are comparable to some of the bigger games that are coming out. It's just that we don't necessarily have the voice to tell people about them. That's the biggest challenge, getting the news out, getting the information out that we have games to play and that we think people would like playing them. Because there's so many games, it's really hard to stand out. I mean, ideally, I'd like a billboard and a television campaign and, you know, I want to see our game plastered on the side of buses. But, you know, the only avenue we have at the moment is the internet. And the internet's really big and it's really hard to draw eyes. And everyone's trying to do it, so it sort of is really hard to not get lost in sort of a sea. You know, there's down to kids that are 17, 18 charging developers, you know, $100 for a review. Like, everyone is trying to make money out of it. And people are paying that money because they just are so desperate to get the news out. So, yeah, the internet's where it's at, but it's also the biggest thing that we have to overcome as well.
I want to be able to build a company that nurtures and encourages, but it also has a really nice environment where you want to work. If I could make Google, but as a games company, I would. I think your employees are the most important things. You don't have a game unless you have people making it, and having that quality of life at a company for me is really important.
What advice would you give to anyone thinking about entering the games industry?
You've got to be passionate, but really realistic. Know that, you know, your first game isn't going to make $1 million. It's not going to make $1,000. It's a long game. It's a hard slog. So just be really, really prepared for rejection and you know, disappointment. Before I made games, I was an actor just for a little while. And it's exactly the same for me. Putting games out in the world and going to auditions, you know, there's so many similarities between the two. If you want to do it, it's really hard. But if you keep slogging away at it, you might have some success. Yeah.
Where on the internet can we find more information?
www.screwtapestudios.com.
Or you can go to Screwtape Studios on Facebook, or follow us at Screwtape Studio at Twitter. That was their fault, not ours.
Excellent. All right, thanks very much, guys.
Cool.
Thank you.
For eons, the sword of Akronox has existed. Suspended in time by a force unfathomable to mankind. Lost souls flock to its fey magic, and it in turn has given them a place to rest. Until now.
I am Alex Norton, the creative director at Visual Outbreak, working on Malevolence, the Sword of Akronox. It's trying to bring back the old first-person RPG genre from the late 80s and early 90s. If you've ever played games like Might and Magic, Eye of the Beholder, Dungeon Master, Stonekeep, Anvil of Fate, any of those fantastic grid-based, turn-based, or real-time games, some of them, Malevolence is a direct homage to that, trying to bring that style of movement and gameplay into a modern engine. But the key factor about it is that the game world is infinite, as well as persistent. So when you start the game, you can walk a million miles in one direction, come back, and everything will still be there. Well, I wanted to have a story that never ends, really. I wanted people to be able to have a game where if they want to play it for just a short while, they can. If they want to play it for a long while, they can. If they want to keep playing it until they get sick of it, they can. There's no end to it, because that's the worst thing is you find a really good game that you like and you sit down and you play it like mad because it's so good, and then you realize that it's over and there's no more to it. And it's sort of this like... you know, le petit moi, you know, you have to stop and you sort of, oh, this is it? Really? And you've got to wait for a sequel, and then you get the sequel and it's not quite as good. So I wanted to make a game that makes itself And it's important to me because when I was growing up, my dad worked night shifts, so he didn't have time to, you know, read me bedtime stories and that. So instead, I'd sit next to him in a beanbag while he played games like Might and Magic. And he would name one of the characters after him, one after me, and one after my sisters and things like that. And we would go on adventures together. Instead of reading a storybook, it would be actually living the story through this game, this portal, you know, on the desk into these huge, vast worlds. And Might and Magic, I don't know if you've ever played them, the worlds are very big, you know, and childhood only lasts for so long. So they did sort of give it to us, but I never wanted them to end. It always ended with Mum coming in and saying, come on, it's time for bed, you can't stay up all night. So we'd have to save the game and come back another time. I never wanted it to end, so Malevolence is my way of being able to do that. I can now give people this story that will never end if they don't want to. There are a lot of games out there that are infinite, but they're not persistent. You can't go back the way you came as well as you could. Games like Minecraft are very, very large and persistent, but they're not infinite. Eventually, you'll get to a point where the world starts breaking. There's no real way that you could get there without using cheats, because it's so far. I think that the Minecraft world is about the equivalent to the surface area of Pluto or something. It's a huge world. But sometimes that's still not big enough, you know? So Malevolence has sort of broken past that, and we've invented a new type of procedural generation that hasn't existed before to make a truly infinite world.
Now, what are the biggest challenges you've faced as an independent developer?
The biggest one would have to be the public, really. A lot of people, they're used to, you know, they're playing something like Modern Warfare 3 and the servers go down and they jump on the forums and start saying, oh, you bastards going through and cutting out my game. And they forget that, you know, a big company like that's fine, they just absorb and deflect, but indie games, they're made by just a few people that just, you know, have wives, they have homes, they have pets, and the game is more than just a job for them. They're not making it to make money, they're making it to raise it and nurture it like a child. It's something they love and care very, very deeply for. They don't realize that when they do, they're hate spamming on it because they don't like something about it, that it really is, it's a big deal to read that sort of thing sometimes. And I think people forget the human side of indie games, and that's probably been the biggest difficulty.
So this will be your first release game. Are you afraid of the criticism that you might face from the public?
I used to be, quite a bit. But then last year, we actually got nominated for Indie Game of the Year, and the game's not even finished yet. And that sort of made me think, well, you know. And then the Kickstarter happened, and we got 500% of what we asked for. And so I think, oh, well, then now I sort of, somebody goes, oh, your game sucks, the movement's dumb, yay, that's awful. I just think, well, you make a game and have an indie nominated. you get funded five times over. Go for it. You're welcome to try. I've already done it.
So what's sort of what's the best part about being independent?
Not being told what you have to put in your game. Because, like I was saying before, in making an indie game, it's about love and passion. You've got to love your game. You've got to love the characters in it. It's got to be such a part of your life. So if you had a producer suddenly walk into your office and say, you know what, my daughter's in this real pony craze at the moment, add ponies to the game, that's really going to mess with your zen thing, you know? That's and you don't have that as an indie. Yeah, it's harder financially, it's harder emotionally and time constraints and things like that, but there is nobody to tell you, no, that's silly, you can't do it. Doesn't matter how silly you can possibly think of, if it's fun and you love it, you can make it. I want to get into mobile development after this is done, and I had an idea for a game called Tank Catapult, where you're a catapult that flings tanks. Just because.
Yeah.
But I think that would be really fun. No production company would ever invest in that. But I can do it because I'm an indie, and I'm paying for it, and I'm releasing it. So I think that's an amazingly powerful thing because of how personal games can be. And you have the freedom to be personal if you are independent.
And what advice would you give to anyone thinking about entering the games industry?
Stop thinking about it and do it. Simple as that. I once saw this picture. I know this seems like a little bit of a segue, but it makes sense at the end. I saw this picture, how to draw an owl. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's this picture of draw some guide circles, and then it's got a picture of this beautifully rendered owl. It says, draw the fucking owl. And that's what it's about. All these people are like, oh, I know how to program, but oh, it's a lot of work to make a game. Or, oh, I'm an animator. Yeah, I've got a friend who's a programmer, but it seems like so much work. We can't agree on an idea. Just do it. Find an idea. Think this would be funny. Don't think, oh, other people won't like it. If you like it, if it's funny, just do it. And it's getting over that fear, because as soon as you've been playing around for a week, you know, dabbled and got a rough prototype working, you will fall in love with that game and it will become a thing. And until that stage, I mean, it takes people to actually start, to actually finish. And that's the biggest thing. A lot of people think, oh, you know, if I put all that work in, it might not make any money. It doesn't matter. If you're proud of the work and the money doesn't come, at least you'll have the work.
Where can we get more information on the internet?
You can go to msoagame.com. So it's just Malevolent Sword of Akronox.com. And from there, there's links to everything. But you can look us up on Facebook, on Twitter. We're just Sword of Akronox. It's at Sword of Akronox. The Facebook, just type in Malevolence, the Sword of Akronox. The good thing is, if you are worried about trying to find us, just start typing Malevolence into Google, and it will come up as a suggestion when you get to about Malevo, and it pops up and says Malevolence. So just click that, and the whole front page of results of Google will be all of the Facebook, the Twitter, the official website, the blogs. It's all there. Very easy.
All right, over the weekend, we had the chance to play some of the indie games that are being developed right here in Brisbane.
Yes.
Now, Jody, I believe there's one game in particular you haven't been able to put down.
Yeah, even in my research beforehand, I downloaded a game called Ski Safari and have been hooked on it ever since, and have been showing it to everyone and have got three or four people to buy it because it's a 99-cent game.
I don't know why you don't work in their marketing department, really. I've already bought it and you've only been sitting here for 20 minutes.
Because they can get him to hire do it me. For free.
Clearly.
But I wouldn't need to do other things if they were paying me. I could all the time, all I could be doing is selling Ski Safari.
So, well, like over 4 days, you've made four sales.
Yeah, that's $4 almost.
That's right.
So why don't you take this opportunity to sell the game some more to the public, Jody? Okay.
Ski Safari is an endless runner. You're skiing downhill in front of this avalanche that's constantly threatening to catch up and bury you under the snow.
Oh.
As you leap over rocks, you've been playing the game, you've just realized what it's about.
Well, I didn't see the thing behind. I mean, I can't see an avalanche behind me. I'm just playing.
Candy didn't realize that you were on skis either.
I didn't. No,
you start out on a bed and then you're on skis.
Oh, yeah. Well, now I'm on a penguin, but please continue.
The safari part of it comes from all of the other animals that are racing down the endless mountain in front of you, including penguins and yetis.
Yetis.
And when you hit the animals, you turn them into skis, which is so much fun.
Sorry.
Yeah. They should have named the game I'm on a Yeti, because that's what everyone says when they play it.
Yeah. And then, I'm on a Yeti, and now the Yeti is riding a skidoo with me.
And now there's a penguin as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Those are your names for sequels, DLC, whatever.
Yeah. He's available for work, people.
Mm-hmm. we also got to play a sweet game called Bank Job. Well, I did. Did you guys play that one?
Yeah, I've been playing that.
Yeah, I'm still playing Ski Safari.
It's a free-to-play game done by the Screwtape guys for iOS and Android?
Yeah.
Yep. It's a sweet auto-runner. You're a little thief trying to bust out of a maximum security kind of bank, and you got to pick up loot, and there's hats, and it's pretty fun, pretty solid entry into the runner franchise.
Yeah, what's different about it is that instead of, you know, tapping to leap over obstacles like in Ski Safari or Cannibalt, you're tapping to hide. So you jog along and then some huge security laser pops up and you tap to flatten yourself against the wall as it comes past. But you have to duck out from the wall to collect coins and gems and wads of cash that are bouncing along as well. And it uses music really well. When you flatten yourself against the wall, there's this sort of rising saxophone tone, this sort of noirish thing that sort of accompanies you. It's, I know it works because it makes you feel tense, like...
That's what noir does.
Yeah. I am impressed by the constant innovation in the endless runner genre that has arisen on the iPhone. Like, because there's only a single means of interacting, you would think that eventually you'd kind of run out of ways of using that. But, you know, we've seen so many, you know, new games in this weird little niche area, and there are still more coming out. There's one that looks really exciting that's coming out later in the year that is about a guy who's like punching his way through a haunted house, and it's still an endless runner, but it feels like a fighting game because all of your taps are like just constant biff 'em up kind of moves. It seems really, really kinetic and interesting ways of you know, comboing along.
Yeah, between you know, Bank Job, Jetpack Joyride, that was a highly successful game done by the Half Brick guys, and games like Penny Time by Ivy Motion. I mean, you know, there's some great running games coming out of Brisbane. It's almost like the signature style.
We're marathon people here. We like to run.
And also another game, Run Fatty Run, that was on display over the weekend.
I didn't try Run Fatty Run. Was it as good as its name?
It's pretty good. It's like, yeah, it's a runner. You tap, you know, you're a fat man. You're running from a tiger.
A larger gentleman.
You may be a fat man.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, a large gentleman. Yeah.
You're on the heavy side.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're
thick.
Running.
Hefty.
Your motivation.
Big boned.
Okay.
Let's morbidly obese.
Okay. So you're a grotesque then.
You're a big man.
You're just a man with a, you know, a few extra pounds.
XXL.
Okay. Whatever. Your main motivation is there's a tiger chasing you. And you die if, you know, the tiger catches you.
Oh, is that the spoiler alert right there? You die?
Yeah, that's how The Dark Knight Rises ends. A tiger eats a fat man.
But what's so good about this game, okay, you tap to run, and the faster you tap, the faster you run. There's obstacles to go through, but there's like a up and down field of view. So you can like go up and down to avoid obstacles, which is a cool little innovation.
Does he lose weight whilst he's running?
I didn't play it that much to tell you that. But, you know, I gave it a good 5 or 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah?
And, yeah, you can bust through obstacles. And there's also power-up donuts on the ground, but you can't eat them because the guy, the fatty, will eat them, and then the tiger will catch up to him while he's eating them.
Oh, so you have to stop to eat. It's not like an eat and run.
No, you can't stop and eat. You have to avoid the donuts.
Are there a hazard?
Yeah, they're a hazard, not a power-up.
Oh, so it has a positive message
then. It's a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Don't eat the donuts.
Makes you think.
Get up and exercise. Don't eat the donuts.
Yep, or a tiger will eat you.
That's a good motto to have.
Yeah. What other games did we play?
We played Viking Burger.
Viking
Burger. Which
I'm loving the names that are coming out of this.
Yes,
really.
Viking Burger was by Genius Interactive, and we were lured over to their wee little booth by the magnificent artwork on display, which was just excellent. Had a really cool kind of indie comic book style of illustration. The chaps themselves would describe it as a standard burger-making game, which is a thing, actually, but that is super niche.
So when you say standard burger-making game, I've played a couple of burger-making games. I've played, like, that Sky Burger one.
Yeah.
No, I know this. As
you
somebody
may be the
that,
expert.
Well, as somebody that doesn't even eat meat, for some reason, I quite enjoy playing burger games.
She likes constructing it.
I do, right? So one is called Sky Burger, where, you know, you start off with the bun, and they're all, like, falling.
You,
so is it like that, where you've got this ever-growing stack of ingredients that you have to catch? Or is it, like, the kind of sushi games, like the other burger games where you have customers come in, you've got ingredients, and you have to make the burgers quickly and not stuff up.
Yes, you have to arrange the correct order of ingredients, and you have to do that to a time limit, and you have to try to be as accurate as possible while avoiding the unpleasant ingredients, and then eventually
what are the unpleasant ingredients?
There's like a CD and a fish head and a hand and stuff, because you're a
Viking?
You're a Viking who has been defrosted.
How do you know you might not like fish head and hands?
Well, no, he's the one making the burgers for ordinary people.
Oh, right.
He's been defrosted, and it's about he has to achieve a level of customer satisfaction before the dissatisfaction level makes him freak out and start murdering the rest of the people in the restaurant.
I'm loving that.
And the best thing about it, though, is it has a full story mode, and there are these like complex dialogue-filled cutscenes between each level of burger making.
Seriously.
Yeah.
You know, it slightly reminds me of Minotaur in a China shop.
Oh, yeah, that same sort of...
Yeah, you have to keep this crazy mythological character calm through shopping. Otherwise, he freaks out and goes into a roid rage.
Yes. It is. I think Minotaur in a China Shop is one of my favorite browser games, actually. I could play that forever.
Yes. I'm terrible at it.
But even being terrible at it means, you know, you can still continue to win.
Yeah.
Because then you've got your insurance policy covering all of the breakages.
We are currently talking about the Indie Game Symposium that Lee, Jody and I attended on the weekend. We've been talking about some of the games we played. A couple more of them.
Malevolence,
and what was that other one?
You guys played some Tail Drift.
Yeah.
Yes.
So let's talk about Malevolence first. We heard from Alex Norton of Visual Outbreak before. Very ambitious title. Looks to be one of the most ambitious indie game titles I've seen.
Yeah, well, he said he's basically cracked the problem surrounding infinite content, because Malevolence is a kind of dungeon crawler, first person kind of game, but in the old school turn based variety. But apparently, it procedurally generates content forever in all directions, but in a way that means that everyone is still playing the same game. So if you find something a million miles in one direction that's really cool, you can tell a friend and they can walk all the way out there and see it as well. So that, I guess the ideas behind it I find really fascinating and really, really encouraging.
Yeah, and what we played of it was fun. It was just a little taste of the dungeon crawling bit, so it wasn't the huge infinite overworld full of towns and things to explore. It was just a dungeon full of monsters and traps which killed us.
Yes, yes. Jody, your experience, I think, was pretty much standard for everyone else who was there.
Yeah, I think I died in a similar way to the way a lot of people died.
Yes.
I did quite well, killed a few orcs and imp-looking things, and then I saw a glowing green circle thing on the ground and thought, that looks interesting, I'll step on it.
I told you to go into it.
Yeah, Lee tempted me.
Yeah.
Look at that. And that's all it took. I was like, all right, I'll go and stand on that. And it wasn't a teleporter or a power-up, it poisoned me.
Yeah.
And the screen started to go green and I lost some hit points, but over on the wall, there was this font gushing out pure life-giving water.
It looked delicious.
Yeah, it made me thirsty just looking at it. So I ran over to drink that, and it also turned out to be poison. Yeah,
double poison.
Yes.
They don't cancel each other out.
You'd think, but no.
And then you reeled backwards from your double poison.
Yeah, stumbling with hit points dropping off me and the screen turning green, I walked straight into a spike trap and died.
So look out for that one.
Yeah.
If you survive the first 3 minutes, there's infinite content in all directions.
Yeah, we're certainly looking forward to that one. That's a PC game, I believe, that'll be out
at the end of the year, he's saying?
21st of December.
Malevolence, and it is malevolent because it killed me.
Yeah.
All right, and what else?
I played a little bit of Universe, which is an iOS game, I think probably coming to the Android as well, by another local developer, which is secretly kind of a Tetris game where you are placing randomized components in a way that you have to ensure you still have enough pieces in the field. But it's designed around maintaining a working galaxy. So you have a sun that is, you know, the thing that all of your planets will orbit, and you have different size planets, and then randomly within that you will have asteroids and things. You basically have to place things so that all of the orbits don't smash into one another, and so that your population in your galaxy will rise. Mm. So you can, you know, once you've got enough of a population going, you can launch you know, vessels from one populated planet onto hopefully another one, and you try to grow your population in your galaxy while avoiding catastrophic collisions. It's a lot of fun. It's a really clever idea.
Mm.
So is it a whole galaxy or just one solar system? Do you have a whole bunch at once?
I think it's just one right. Solar system. So yeah, it's called Universe, and the designer was talking about galaxies. It is in fact a solar system.
I can see how it would be Tetris-y, because I was watching it. I didn't get a chance to play that one. But you can see what's coming next, whether it's a life-giving planet or a huge gas giant or an asteroid.
Yeah.
And he was saying that he was surprised that people had started using the asteroids to blow up planets they didn't like. or other asteroids, which he hadn't expected people to do. He thought the asteroids would just be a bad thing and people would throw them out into distant orbits and try to avoid them. But people started playing it in different ways.
Yeah, something that we learned from the developers when we were talking to them was that it was really cool to see like a whole bunch of people playing their games that were on display, because they can get the insight and be able to talk to the dudes themselves and get, you know, some more feedback on the game.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Well, we're out of time for this week, guys. But next week, when we celebrate our awesome 128th episode, Candy, you'll be talking about the Game Masters event, which we unfortunately didn't have time to talk about this week.
That's quite all right. I was thoroughly enjoying your topic tonight. But yes, Game Masters, the exhibition, is currently on at Melbourne at the Australian Centre for Moving Image, so we can talk about that next week.
Yep, and big thanks again to Jodie McGregor for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me, guys.
And also thank you to all the indie devs that we spoke to over the weekend, as well as the organisers of the event.
Thank you for not being weirded out by us.
Yeah. and if you'd like more information about the Zed Games program, please head to our blog, zedgamesau.net, or our Facebook, which is facebook.com/zedgamesau. But before we go, we have time for maybe a song or two. Jody.
This is from the Portal 2 soundtrack, which is apparently put together by the Aperture Science Psychoacoustics Laboratory. It's called Turret Wife Serenade.
All right, we'll catch
it's
you next
song.
In the year 2012, the Earth was attacked by an extraterrestrial military force, destroying 98% of all living creatures. 84 years later, humans studied fragments of abandoned alien spacecrafts and gained the ability to travel through time. In order to prevent the devastating attack of 2012, the humans sent back four protectors with a mission to defend the Earth at any cost. Together, these four protectors formed Zed Games, the most powerful force that the Earth has ever known. Now, Zed Games is all that stands between us and the impending invasion. Long live the planet Earth. Long live Zed Games.